The views expressed in this podcast are those of the contributors, not of Q1 Media.
Hello, listeners. This is your host, Ryan Oliver. On behalf of the Gotcha Movies podcast team, we want to wish everybody a happy holidays. And we're just letting you know that the format of this episode is going to be a little different this time, with a lot of movies to cover around the holiday season. I'm meeting with each co-host one-on-one to discuss the new movies coming out. It's a format we probably won't do ever again, but it's the only way we could get everyone on board and to talk about all the movies that are coming out. So we hope you enjoy the show. And once again, happy holidays. Listening to the Gotcha Movies podcast, the official podcast of GotchaMovies.com. I'm Ryan Oliver.
I'm Taylor Dvorsky.
How's your Sunday evening going, bud?
Slow. I've had the weekend off work, so that's good. I did my top 10 list, wrote it all out. So, yeah, that's mainly what I've done today.
Oh, nice. Those take a while, man.
They do. It took me a couple hours.
It took me a couple days, really, just like staring at it and figuring out what I wanted to write and then be like, wait, is my number 10? Wait, my 11's good too. Do I include it?
I had the chance to do like my last bits of rewatching to see if stuff was going to stay on it or stuff maybe will make it on there. And I rewatched a couple films over the last two nights that were in debate. So
I did too, but my list is currently actually up on the site. I'm pretty satisfied with it for my final 10.
Yeah, so I'm satisfied with mine. I think they're all good choices on my end, stuff I really liked. And I'm glad. Yeah, so it was a good year. It was tough. It was a good year for movies.
Yeah, it's been very, very tough. So I'm excited to read your top 10 when it comes out.
Awesome. And I read yours.
Oh, well, thank you. So we're going to start off this episode. This is our big old Christmas episode. We got a lot of movies to talk about. I'll be joined by our other co-hosts later in the show to talk about different movies. But we're here to kick things off with the end of a popular trilogy. No, we're not talking about Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, even though we both have unfortunately seen it.
It happened.
It happened. That's all you could really say. There's nothing to talk about it.
Dan Stevens is good.
Yeah.
But if you like Dan Stevens, go watch The Guest.
Yes, yeah, go watch The Guest. It's on digital HD, so please give that movie the love it needs. Yeah, basically Taylor's review sums it up. What's good about the movie? Dan Stevens. What's bad or just bland? Everything. Everything else about the movie is bad.
Yep. That's that. That's the movie. It's Night at the Museum 3 in a nutshell, and nothing else to say.
Yep. So, nope, nothing else. So we're moving on to the actual trilogy capper that people are going to see, which is The Hobbit: Battle of the Five Armies.
My lord, dispatch this force to Ravenhill. The dwarves are about to be overrun. Thorin must be warned.
By all means, warn him. I've spent enough elvish blood in defense of this accursed land. No more.
Andrew!
I'll go.
Don't be ridiculous. You'll never make it.
Why not?
Because they will see you coming and kill you.
No, they won't. They won't see me.
It's out of the question. I won't allow it.
I'm not asking you to allow it, Gandalf.
So, I guess before we dive into this one, because this actually marks kind of our 1 year anniversary of the Gotcha Movies podcast. I know, Taylor, before you were a frequent member on the show, our first episode, we talked about The Desolation of Smaug.
You mean Smaug, so by the movie pronunciation.
Is it Smaug? Smaug?
They say, I don't know, it caught me off guard when they called it Smaug in the movie, and I've been making, I jokingly call it that ever since.
I'm going to call it Smug.
Smug.
Smug. So I guess, I mean, how have you felt about the Hobbit trilogy as a whole, I guess?
I guess underwhelmed, obviously, but I kind of knew it was always going to be like that when it was announced that they were making it into a trilogy. I knew that that was never going to be a sound creative decision because it's not a long book.
No, 300 pages.
It's like, I thought personally, when I heard it was going to be two films, I was fine with that. Like, I think the best thing they could have done, they either could have made a one really long, like three and a half hour movie, or if they really wanted to make sure they packed all the content, do two movies at no more than 2 hours apiece. Mm-hmm. I think would have been the best way. It's not what's happened. We got three very, well, the third one's the shortest, but still three pretty long films. I thought the first one was just a bore to sit through. I did not like the first one at all. Smaug, I liked more. I think that actually might be tied with the third one as far as the ones I enjoyed most. Either way, I haven't thought any of them were great.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. It's kind of interesting because originally this was going to be two movies, like you touched on. And I kind of just thought about this last night before we recorded, and it didn't really dawn upon me when I first watched the Battle of the Five Armies, but you could totally tell that these last two movies were not meant to be two movies. It just kind of dawned on me because it's like the Desolation of Smaug. I'm going to have to say it like that now because you made me do it. Smaug. Because that one ends on a cliffhanger, like it's an end of a television episode. And then this one immediately starts with the dragon wreaking havoc on the town. And so it's like the second movie is just like one long second act, really. It's all that it is. Mm-hmm. And then the third movie is like kind of like The Matrix Revolutions is the movie that I've kind of compared it to. And then it's one long climax. It's just like one big battle.
It's a giant battle sequence. Yep. I think too, because I was reading, let me actually pull it up real quick. Let me fact check this before I say it, but it's about, I think, the way they shot it, and that, like, it, let's see, hold up, let me find it real quick. Okay, this one, originally only going to be two films, the filming wrapped on July 6, 2012, after 266 days of principal photography. However, following the decision to split the story into three films, the two films became the first and last, and the ending from the first film became the beginning of the now second film, and likewise, the beginning of the third film became the end of the second film. So additional scenes for the second film were written and shot during several months of summer 2013.
That does not surprise me, because Smaug has a lot of filler in it. And so does the first one, too. But the first movie, I'm 100% in your camp in that movie is a slog. That movie is a bore. It is not a good movie. But it does have an arc. I feel like that movie has an arc, like a deliberate three-act structure, mm-hmm. whereas these next two movies do not. No, really? No, they don't. Mm-hmm. They just kind of bleed into each other. So yeah, that doesn't surprise me that they reshot scenes for the second one. It feels forced, like some of the stuff.
It's like they shot enough to justify a feature running time, but then they overshot that and made a 2-hour and 40-minute movie.
Yeah, definitely. I guess if I had to say, I guess this is the best one of the three, if I had to pick one.
That's my opinion too. Like, it's not like I say it enthusiastically. I will be honest in saying I think I enjoyed Smaug more than a lot of people. Not like a lot of people, but I thought it was all right. Like, I did enjoy it definitely a lot more than the first one. I think this one, I think it is like tied at least for the best, maybe a slight edge. I say that, you know, trepidly, like none of these are like great. It's not a great movie.
Right.
But like it's an action sequence. It's largely just the battle of the five armies. It's a big action sequence. So you have to like action.
The title is not just a clever name.
It's largely like that second half is just fighting. But like, I liked that part of it. Cause I think I didn't like all of it, but like, I think Peter Jackson still does shoot action well. He may have shot too much of it for this one, but I think he shoots it well. I only wish he did not rely so heavily on CG as he's done with this entire trilogy.
I totally agree. But I'm going to try and stray away from that argument because it's kind of a long winded one at this point. I know we've made that argument several times with this series. So we'll kind of stay away from it because I think people know how we feel about the CGI in these movies.
About the CG, yeah.
But yeah, that being said, yeah, there are some moments in this movie that are like wow-worthy. Like, they were missing from the other movies for me. Like, there are definitely some scenes in the battle. I did forget about the guy who transforms into a bear. And so when an eagle drops him into the battlefield, he transforms into a bear. I forgot about that. I thought an eagle just dropped a bear into the battlefield for no reason at all. Because why not? Who cares? It's already insane.
Yeah.
Might as well just do that. But like, there's some moments that I like was like entertained by. And it is the shortest. It's like 2 hours and 24 minutes. It still feels like a slog, though.
It is long. I think the first, like, almost half of it before the battle, when it's just like, oh, Thorin's becoming corrupted and they're just trying to, it's kind of building up to that. I thought that part was very boring. I thought it was some of the worst writing that has occurred in this series. A lot of the dialogue I did not like.
I would agree totally. And part of where the Matrix Revolutions comparison comes in for me is that, like, that movie I felt was a huge slog to sit through, because when you have so much action and so much just repetitiveness and it's not exciting, like, I mean, The Raid sure is like repetitive action, but it's exciting action. It's visceral action. And this is just like, you know, I'm watching CGI orcs fight CGI elves and CGI dwarfs. And it's just like, I know we said we weren't going to talk about the CGI, but like,
It is what it is.
And they're like just nameless casualties. And in like the Matrix Revolutions, they just fight these sentinels for 2 hours and 10 minutes and no, like, build upon any of the ideas they brought up in the second movie. So it's just like, it's just a slog to sit through despite moments of awe.
Mm-hmm. And I think a thing you can say too about movies being action heavy, it doesn't have to be a bad thing, like you said, with The Raid and even like The Raid 2. Films like that, I think the fact that they're so action heavy works, because it's like each action scene kind of builds in scale or just durate, and just each builds upon the next. Whereas with something like Battle of the Five Armies, it is just one large scale battle.
Mm-hmm.
And like you get the moments of like one on one combat that makes it a little more intimate, but it's still just grand scale.
Well, that's the thing, is I'm like, I'm watching nameless characters fight each other, and I don't really know necessarily what the stakes are in the movie. I think that's the biggest issue for me, is that I'm like, I don't know what we're fighting for necessarily, and then there's just a bunch of fan service to like shoehorn in, like, to Lord of the Rings, essentially. Like, there's a really bad line, I don't want to say it, I guess, because it may be a spoiler, but like, they tell Legolas that he needs to go meet somebody, and like, you know who that person is, and it's so painful. It's like,
but with three additional lines, they really want to make sure you know.
Yeah, just in case you didn't get the first time, they're gonna hammer home that this person is exactly who you think it is. So
it's yeah, and I still, and a part of me still, I think I talked about this in my review a little bit, that I almost feel kind of nostalgic for Peter Jackson's time in Middle-earth, I guess, with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, that it was still a little sad to see him go, and like, he's not making any more of these films, and I felt nostalgic about that, but I also just think I want to watch Lord of the Rings again, is what that mainly made me want to do.
Oh yeah, I'm totally with you. I don't have, despite being a teenager when those movies came out, or a young, you know, at my adolescence, I don't know. I don't love those movies the way a lot of people do. I don't think I love them as much as you do. I definitely don't love them as much as our editor Jenny does. Like, I think they're grand movies. Like, I think they're excellent pieces of cinema. I don't revisit them, but that doesn't mean that they're not great. And so, because the Hobbit series as a whole robs that majestic feel and that scope of those movies, there's nothing for me personally to grasp onto, because it's just not a genre that I usually flourish in.
Mm-hmm. See, and I do very much love those movies, and I was actually even younger than you when I saw them, but I actually like did see them in a theater when I was, I believe, let's see, I was 7, 8, and 9 when those movies came out. And as a 9-year-old in a theater, I was still totally transfixed watching all of them, or like 7, 8, 9. I was still transfixed the whole time, even at that age, like a 9-year-old, and I sat through like the 3.5-hour long Return of the King, and it was my favorite movie for a very long time.
Oh, I could see that being that age. I was 11, 12, and 13 when they came out. And I still love them, but like my experience, like that you just described, for me was, when they re-released the original Star Wars trilogy in 97. And I went and saw all three of those in the theaters as a 7-year-old and was like completely transfixed by them. Like, that was the one that had the experience.
So that's an experience I wish I could have had. Unfortunately, in 97, I was 3 years old. So.
Yeah, no, don't totally. I understand. Hopefully, they should re-release them someday. Maybe when the new one comes out, I would say.
So I would love to see the originals in a theater.
Yeah, I would love to see them again, because I remember them. It's like definitely a memory I have, but I definitely would like my memory re-jogged about them, because that, seeing all six of those in the theater, yeah, even the prequels. I like the Star Wars prequels are like the more, I'm about the Star Wars prequels the way that you are about these Hobbit movies. It's like you're nostalgic and like maybe forgiving of the like final one, because it is the last one. kind of the way I am with Revenge of the Sith. I mean, I do think it is the best of the prequels if I had to pick one, but it's more like because it got closer to the story that I love, I just like I was forgiving about it. And it sounds like you're in that same way with Battle of the Five Armies.
Yeah, that's just the way I feel. Although I did actually see the original or the Star Wars prequel trilogy in theaters when those came out, and I just liked Revenge of the Sith at the time.
Yeah, oh yeah, I think it's definitely like a semi decent movie. In hindsight, the other two are not, but
oh no.
But Revenge of the Sith is the better one. But it's just I don't know. As a whole, the trilogy it is the equivalent of the Star Wars prequels, I think, in that you have it's something is missing in the translation. Like it's weird that the magic of what worked before could not be harnessed and worked again.
Mm-hmm. But, I don't want to pull, I guess, cause I know we said we bring up the CGI argument too much, but I almost think
if you have to,
but you can apply that. I think the same with the Hobbit trilogy to the Lord of the Rings, as you can to the prequel trilogy and the original trilogy, because I think George Lucas got way too computer graphics happy on those films.
I think that's a good point, is because both Lucas with the prequels and Peter Jackson with these movies, they were more interested. I actually said this, if listeners are so inclined to go back, I said this all the way last year in my Desolation of Smaug review, is that they were both Lucas and Jackson with these prequel trilogies are more interested in pushing the boundaries of technology than they are actually coming up with a compelling story.
Because, they're more about exploring the new tech they have. Just like with, even with, like, the original, or with the prequel Star Wars trilogy, I think, like, Lucas was really starting to pioneer shooting on digital over film.
I think Attack of the Clones, I don't quote me on this, I'll have to double check, but I think it was the first major studio movie to be shot on digital.
I think I read that in a text somewhere too. And then like with the Hobbit prequel trilogy, you've got Peter Jackson exploring the high frame rate, which I actually never saw any of the Hobbit movies in. I never wanted to.
Me neither.
And then also just like he would kind of like the shooting on the red epic with shooting 3D as well. So that was like he was trying to explore tech more than the narrative.
Exactly. And same thing with Lucas. He's just like, we have all this, CG was kind of new at that time. I mean, not new, but like it was getting better every week. So he's like, oh, let's see what we can do with this. And then he's trying to shoot digitally and then using green screen. And it's like, what happened to, shooting out in the deserts? And same thing with Lord of the Rings. It's like, what happened to shooting out in the, in New Zealand in the terrain? But instead, I feel like they're just, they're in a studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the magic of the story is lost to the technological, new age technologies they could utilize.
Right. And it's a movie that demands so much from its technical abilities because it's like, it's like, I don't know, it's like something like Game of Thrones on HBO, like when it's nominated for awards. I mean, yeah, you get a few actors, but like that show is nominated for its craft and like, yeah, picture and directing, sure. But like, they're not like known for their acting. It's for the story. And so it's like, if you don't have the story in this and the scope isn't what you want it to be and the effects aren't working for you, then nothing works. Nothing really works.
Oh, so yeah, that sums it up.
And it's also unfortunate because I think Martin Freeman is an excellent Bilbo Baggins, but somehow found a way to be a supporting character in his own story.
Kinda, yeah. There was a time, yeah. It's basically he doesn't get as much, especially in this one.
Yeah, he's really like you forget. You're like, wait, this is called The Hobbit, right? Why don't we see much of where the Hobbit? Where'd he go? Yeah, we know he's small, but come on.
It's this one has probably way more Thorin than I would have liked.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked him in Smaug. I think there's some good stuff in that movie. I'm actually kind of on the same page with you. That movie is still a slog to sit through. It's still pretty boring for most part, but Bilbo's confrontation with Smaug himself is really, really impressive in that movie. And I think Thorin's character work is really good too. Richard Armitage who plays him. But here,
it doesn't have as much arc in this one.
No, because he's reached his arc, essentially. Yeah, and now he's got his Arkenstone. Is that what that is?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay. The Arkenstone. Okay. Yes. I'm surprised I remember that, to be honest, because I did not remember a lot of the previous movies before going into this one. Like, there was a plot element that I, like Gandalf, when he starts out in Battle of Five Armies, wherever he's at, I was like, oh yeah, that's where you ended up.
Because I never like revisited the Hobbit films. I saw them once in theaters and I wasn't eager to see them again.
Yeah, I have no desire to watch these movies ever again. I'm not really upset that I've seen them necessarily, but I don't want to watch them again.
Yeah, because I knew I was going to see them by default, like, because of my attachment to Lord of the Rings, I almost had, like, just by default, I was going to see them. I knew that.
Yeah.
No, but I don't want to revisit them.
No, I definitely don't either. So, yeah, it's more of the same, I think, for the most part, just shorter.
Yeah. It's thankfully, it is only about 2 hours and 25 minutes. So, yeah.
And probably about 2:15 with, you know, not including credits. So,
yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
but it's still kind of too long.
It is still too long, especially when your movie hinges on a huge battle sequence. Like, that's, you got to cut, you got to trim that. You got to trim that down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, I think if your movie hinges on action and there's more action, then I think a film like Deathly Hallows Part 2 did it better.
Yeah, I definitely think it did better too. And we'll see what Mockingjay Part 2 does, but at least Part 1 did a good job like developing what the story is to come. Anyway, this one, and then I'm going to borrow something that my over-under co-host Octa Kozak brought up when we came out of the movie, and he wrote this in his review of the movie as well, that they try to do the Return of the King ending with this movie. Like, they try to, like, have the big send-off and the big goodbye and have it be, like, emotional. But because the movie didn't really earn that moment leading up to that point, it just kind of misfires.
Mm-hmm. Which is, like, you don't feel as attached to the characters in this as you did when you watched Lord of the Rings. There's not nearly as much attachment
in
this
one. It's more bombardment than it is attachment.
Mm-hmm. So, because they tried that, but it doesn't, it's not warranted.
No, it just feels tacked on. So, any other thoughts on The Hobbit before we shift gears?
No, I think that pretty much summed it up here.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, it's probably maybe the best of the trilogy, but that's not like saying it's great.
It's faint praise, basically.
Yeah.
So cool. Awesome. Well, thank you for logging on and talking about The Hobbit. It was fun to go on.
And Night at the Museum. And, don't forget, we briefly talked about that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We talked about Night at the Museum. Well, I was very happy to do a hashtag one last time with you.
Oh. You proud of that?
I'm not my proudest moment, but those advertisements have been in my face for a long time.
Very, very long time. They want you to know.
They it's the last time, guys. It's the last. Because
it's also in the trailer, and goddamn, Thorin says it in the movie.
Yeah, will you join me for one last time? We get it, man. We get it. All right, so now I'm joined by Jenny Nolf. How's your afternoon going, Jenny?
It's going well. I get to work from home today, which is nice. I started the day off by watching the remake of Planet of the Apes, which was amusing at first, and then I got bored after a while.
Yeah, that's not a really good day, or that's not really a good way to start the day, but I haven't seen that movie since it came out in 2001 when we were 11, so I don't really remember too much about it.
Yeah, well, it's probably for the best because there are some really funny parts.
I remember the ending where the ape, the Lincoln Memorial is of an ape. I do remember that.
Oh, yeah, and then all the apes came. I knew about that ending, but I didn't realize that, like, all these police apes come up to him, and then Mark Wahlberg is like, well, fuck.
Yeah, it doesn't really make any sense at all. But so before we dive into, we have one film that you and I have both seen that we'll discuss in full. But there's a couple other Christmas movies that have come out that you have seen and I haven't. If you wanted to tell our audience what you thought about them.
Well, I've actually seen most of all of the Christmas movies aside from The Interview. But since that was pulled, then I have seen all the Christmas movies now. But there are two that you haven't talked about with other people yet. And one is Annie, which I actually kind of liked.
You are in the minority in that one, from the sounds of it.
I feel really awkward about saying it's like, I didn't hate it, but I feel like what a lot of critics like thought when they watched the movie. And I could totally see it from like an adult male's point of view, where this is like probably really dumb to them. But I was sitting by this adorable little kid who would sing and dance to every song, and it kind of brightened the movie a little bit more for me. And that, and it is Annie still. The musical performances aren't amazing. Clearly they looked for big names over vocal talent, but I don't know, it was cute, and it is what it is. As an adult, I could have probably, if I had a kid, take my kid to that and not feel like it was a waste of my time.
It sounds like it's a pretty harmless experience in terms of like content, I guess.
Yeah, and I liked some of the updates. What my biggest problem with the movie is that there's a lot of like overuse of social media and technology where I feel like it almost will date the movie in, I don't know, a year.
Got it. That makes sense. Kind of like the motif recently of like text messaging popping up in movies.
Yeah, except I feel like that in some formats has been creative. But this one, it was like tweets popped up, and Katy Perry had her Prismatic World Tour picture on a tweet that she had. So that obviously in a year when she's not doing that tour anymore.
Mm-hmm. No one's going to hear her roar in a couple years.
Yeah. It'll be another CD. So I felt like it already dated the movie a little bit, and it was kind of overbearing sometimes. But I mean, the music's still the same. They added 3 new songs. One of them is a little bit too like R&B, and it doesn't really match all the other tones of the songs because these are classic musical style songs. But there was this one called Who Am I, and I thought it was a pretty nice addition. I don't know. It was okay. It was a pretty cute update. Cute's the right word.
So it sounds like something you wouldn't have seen on your own accord, but having to go see it for the sake of reviewing it, it was just, you know, it was fine. It sounds like it was good. It was a better experience than you expected.
Yeah, it was a lot better than I expected because I went in not wanting to watch it at all.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I just talked with Taylor before you logged on about that was my experience, the opposite of my experience with Night at the Museum.
Your experience with Night at the Museum? Or his?
I think maybe a little bit of both, in that I had no desire to watch it, but had to watch it, and yeah, and it was awful. But it sounds like you had to watch Annie, but it was better than you expected.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be really horrible. And Cameron Diaz is, oh my God, who lets her act still? That's mean.
Yeah, it is mean to say, and there are some things that I have loved her in, but... it's not unfair to say that at this point. I appreciated that she went for it in The Counselor, even though her performance was all over the place. But I don't disagree with that statement.
Yeah, I think the last thing I liked her in was The Holiday, which was a movie meant for her.
Mm-hmm. I haven't actually seen that, but my fiance loves that movie, so I'm going to have to watch it someday.
It's a very good Christmas movie, so...
Yeah. No, that's what I've heard. So it might be the best time now to watch it. But speaking of the Planet of the Apes remake, you saw the new film that Tim Burton has coming out on Christmas Day?
Yeah, I saw Big Eyes almost a month ago now.
Yeah, I was supposed to see it the other day, but the screening was in the afternoon, and I was hanging with one of my best friends who I hadn't seen in forever, and couldn't take a guest to an afternoon screening, so I did not make it to it.
Oh, no. I actually enjoyed it. Although I will say there's a lot of people toting that it is the best Tim Burton movie since
insert movie here. 90s movie. Yeah.
Or Big Fish, early millennia. And I'm like, no, because clearly everyone forgot about Frankenweenie, I guess, which was his last movie.
Yeah, exactly. And Frankenweenie is excellent. And so is Sweeney Todd. Sweeney Todd's a great movie, too.
Sweeney Todd is really great. And Big Eyes is good. But my problem with it is it just felt like... it was too normal.
Yeah, I kind of got that sense from the trailer. The cinematography looked really good, like really of that era. And, you know, I don't want to like critique or review a movie that I haven't seen. But it looked like Tim Burton going for the type of like based on a true story sort of movies that the Academy goes for, which seemed not fitting of him.
Well, okay. What I think... I'm really glad he made a movie like this, and I'm really glad that it's something different from what he has been doing lately, which is a lot of studio movies, so he can do movies he wants to make, which is that's my theory, because it seems like he gets this, like, Alice in Wonderland comes out, and then he gets to do Frankenweenie, Sweeney Todd comes out, and then he's has to do Dark Shadows.
Right, right, right.
And like it's like there's a connection here, and I just felt like for this one, I was glad he did it, but at the same time, there are like these moments in the film where you're like, oh, that's Tim Burton, and then it just like fades so fast.
And you're like, interesting.
Oh, wait, and then I didn't feel like the performances from Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz were there.
Like they didn't have chemistry, or they just weren't.
They definitely did not have chemistry together, which is sad because I love both of these people.
Got it. Because sometimes Burton, I love Tim Burton, but sometimes the performances aren't necessarily the selling point of his movies.
No, it depends on who it's from, because if he can work well with the person, I feel like their performances are great. But maybe if he doesn't know them that well, their performances can be a lot harder to get from. And I felt like Amy Adams was just being Amy Adams mostly. Like she didn't do anything exceptional out of the ordinary that she doesn't usually do. And Christoph Waltz is the same way.
Yeah, I feel like I love Christoph, but he's some of his roles outside of Tarantino's films are like a little stale or like a little typical that you would expect him to play. And he doesn't like do anything to break that. Like Horrible Bosses 2 or I Didn't See Water for Elephants, but that also seems sort of in that vein.
Yeah. Overall, though, the movie was really enjoyable. I didn't think it's a bad movie at all. It's just like it felt, as a huge Tim Burton fan I am, I was like, you know, that wasn't something I expected from him. And it's something that I didn't really necessarily care for from him either.
Right. It's something you wanted more from it, for him doing that kind of movie, or more of his sensibility.
Especially since I felt like this one had so much you could have done that he could have like added to it to make it him, because it's such a weird story. And there are, like I said, there are these weird moments and then you're like, yes, but then they flit away kind of fast. And I have a feeling that it has to do more with the script than with him as a director, because the script is kind of okay.
Yeah, that makes sense, because it looked like, again, the period looked really well, but like it looked bland in terms of his visual style. And it's like, if you rob him of that, that's usually pretty unfortunate.
Yeah. I don't know. I liked it a lot. I don't think about it much after seeing it, and it just felt kind of sad. And it made me really want to go back and watch Frank and Weenie.
Yeah. I definitely want to go back and watch Frank and Weenie as well. I might actually do that sometime this week. Yeah. I'm going to see it. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to see it. And it sounds like you at least recommend it. But that's a bummer that it's not all that you wanted it to be.
Yeah, it was in my top, I think, 5 most anticipated movies. Like, I think it was number 3 or number... It was really close to the top. And so just to have it just feel kind of like, okay, that was fine, is probably my worst reaction I could have ever had.
Totally. That Big Eyes to you is Inherent Vice to me.
Yeah. Sounds like.
Because that was my number 1 most anticipated of the year.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that.
Yeah. Well, damn. But there is a movie that you and I have both seen, saw a while ago, actually, and it comes out on Christmas Day. So I think we should just dive into that, which is the adaptation of Into the Woods.
Into the woods, it's time to go. I hate to leave, I have to, though. Into the woods, it's time, and so I must begin my journey. Into the woods and through the trees to where I am expected, ma'am. Into the woods to grandmother's house.
Stop it. Now, you're certain of your way?
The way is clear. The light is good. I have no fear, nor no one should. The woods are just trees. The trees are just wood. I sort of hate to ask it, but do you have a basket?
Yes, we do.
Don't suppose you're planning on buying any of these?
Oh, shh, now. Don't stray and be late, all right?
You might save some of those sweets for Granny. Oh, my. She's a thief.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, I am too. So I guess you didn't bury your lead. I'll let you take off. What did you think about Into the Woods?
Well, I was very excited for the movie to begin with. And I loved the music from the musical. I actually haven't seen the musical, but I have listened to the songs before, because I really like Stephen Sondheim as a musical writer who also did Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
And I like director Rob Marshall because I love Chicago.
Yes.
So, and then the cast was pretty perfect, and so I was pretty excited for it. But what surprised me the most is how much I connected with what it was saying in certain scenes, I don't know, it took me by surprise a lot more than I thought it would, and I ended up really, really loving it.
It took me by surprise too, and I didn't really know anything about the musical going in, and the marketing for the movie was giving me sort of mixed signals because I didn't really know what to expect, and a lot of the marketing was hiding the music from the movie, so I didn't even know it was a musical when it first was advertised. I'm just like, oh, this is an amalgamation of all kinds of fairy tales coming together from Disney. No, thank you. I'm not interested in that. And but yeah, I saw Rob Marshall was doing it. I love Chicago. I never saw Nine.
Don't see Nine.
Yeah, I've pretty much heard the exact same thing. There's a lot of pretty people in that movie, but I just can't bring myself to see it. And then the less said about Pirates of the Caribbean 4, the better. But who would have thought that I would have been appreciative that he did that movie? But because it made $1 billion, he got carte blanche to do whatever he wanted and then decided to adapt Into the Woods. And I, other than a clumsy shift into the third act, I really liked this movie. It's funny. It was funny. That's the thing I liked most about it. I really didn't expect it to be that funny and dark and twisted. And the fact that Disney put this out, was really surprised by it. But I guess they own the properties that a lot of the fairy tales are from, so it makes sense. But yeah, I agree with you. The cast in this movie is excellent, and it was a really good time at the movies.
Yeah. And Meryl Streep. I know everyone like is like, oh, she's... It probably sounds like a broken record, but she's really great in this movie.
She is. And it's one of those things. It's unfortunate that, like, because she's going to get nominated for Best Supporting Actress. It's going to happen. And because she gets nominated for everything she's in. And sometimes she doesn't deserve to be. This time she really, truly does deserve to be. So there's going to be the backlash of people who are like, oh, Meryl Streep, she's nominated again. It's like, but she's that good in it. she really is.
So amazing, especially because I remember seeing Mamma Mia, and she was god awful in that movie. And it was a musical, and I was really worried because I was like, great, not another musical with Meryl Streep in it. She's going to ruin this one. But I don't know who coached her with the music, but her voice was great. Her performances are so show stopping.
Agree.
For lack of a better word.
yeah. Don't, no worries. I think you can get hyperbolic with her performance in this movie because she is really, really strong in it. And I think I'd almost compare her performance a little bit to Depp's in Sweeney Todd, in that, like, her voice is definitely better. I never saw Mamma Mia because I don't like ABBA to begin with. So I was just like, no way, I'm not going to see this movie. But I compare it to Depp's performance in Sweeney Todd in that your singing doesn't have to be the best as long as it's doable. And you can act, because if you can act your way through it, like, that'll show through your performance. And because she acts the hell out of it, it really, really works in it. And there's, I mean, she's really, like, she's having a ball. Like, there's scenes where she's clearly just having fun. But then the scenes with her adopted daughter, Rapunzel, like, there actually is a poignancy to it that I didn't expect at all.
Oh, I loved that scene where she sings as it Stay mm-hmm. with Me.
Yeah. Oh,
it's so good. And I got kind of teary-eyed. It's a very good mother-daughter moment.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. And so, yeah, so the play, I mean, I guess for those unfamiliar with it, because I was unfamiliar with it, the whole idea is that these fairy tales all end up in the woods somehow. All these stories do. And it's about how this mythical woods, like, changes your thought process, I guess. Like, these woods change you into doing decisions that you wouldn't normally make. So it's a really funny and at times dark, and it earns its darkness, like, deconstruction of all these fairy tales. I mean, you have Cinderella, and you have Rapunzel, you have Jack and the Beanstalk, you have Little Red Riding Hood, and I think I'm missing one more, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I don't think you're missing one more. I think you're just thinking of the baker and
his
wife, but that's not necessarily...
Mm-hmm. It's kind of their story, I would say, mm-hmm. if anybody. I mean, there's a lot of characters, but I'd say them and Meryl Streep as the witch are kind of the through line of this movie.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I was actually surprised that Johnny Depp didn't stay longer, but I guess it didn't surprise me then, because I was like, oh, he only has one song in the musical, so...
Yeah, and I know you're the biggest Johnny Depp fan I know, and I'm not, like, a hater. I don't have any, like, backlash here or anything. I thought his screen time was perfect. Like, he had his one song, And he's a straight up pervert pedophile in this movie. Like, they don't even like conceal that fact. Like, it's very overt, and he kills it. He's really, really great in it. And he's just perfect for that one scene. And which made sense. I mean, the movie was only budgeted at $50 million, and I was reading in the Hollywood Reporter that this that everyone was working for cheap in this movie to get it made, which I greatly appreciated. That means everyone had a passion for the material that they decided to take on these roles.
Well, that doesn't surprise me with Johnny Depp, because he did, again, he was in Sweeney Todd, which is a Stephen Sondheim movie, which then you mentioned earlier something about the songs and how like the performances work with it. And then you compared Meryl Streep's performance to Johnny Depp's. And I'm thinking that it's not so much the performances too, because they're really great, but also Stephen Sondheim's songs work more as like a rocky, like rock star kind of talk almost music.
They do. And these are the type of musicals that I like. This is why I haven't seen Annie, or why I didn't care for something like Les Mis. Les Mis was just singing all the time. And like Annie's representative of like the old school Hollywood musicals that I respect, because that's, you have to respect them as a film lover. But like when people just break in a song for no reason at all, and like to everyday life, I personally don't enjoy them. That's just not that's a personal preference. But I love like comic musicals or like rock opera type musicals. Like I love this. I love Chicago. I love Sweeney Todd. I love the South Park movie. I love Rocky Horror Picture Show. Like in this movie, I thought was going to be like a boring type musical, and it completely wasn't. It completely caught me by surprise. And I shouldn't have, because it was Sondheim who did Sweeney Todd. I should have known better, but I didn't.
Well, I mean, there was this whole controversy, I think like midsummer, where everyone was saying how like, oh no, the wolf's not going to really be as like overtly pedophile-esque, or oh no, the song in the woods where it's the baker and she meets Cinderella's prince, that's not going to be in that movie. And then like Sondheim came out and he was like, actually, you're all wrong. It's pretty accurate. The only major change was Rapunzel doesn't die, which if you've read the, or not read, if you've seen the musical or know anything about it, you would know that she does die, but she didn't.
Which, speaking of Cinderella's prince, not enough praise can go to Chris Pine. I think he steals this movie from head to toe.
I love him.
The song that he, and I forget the actor who plays his brother in it, but their song Agony, I was busting up through the whole song. I laughed like embarrassingly loud.
It's so funny.
It's really, really funny.
I definitely laughed a lot during that scene. I was like, oh my God, is this serious? They're fighting over who has the most agonizing love.
I know. It's so funny. And it's like, we were just talking a little bit ago before we were recording about celebrity feuds being stupid. And I quoted Louis C.K. about white people problems. And that's basically their whole song. It's like total white people problems about who has the most agonizing love story. And it's hilarious. Yeah, I think I want to see Chris Pine in more things, because, you know, Horrible Bosses 2, which I thought was just like an okay movie, he's excellent in that one too. So I think every movie could use a little Chris Pine at this point.
Yeah, I was quite a fan of him. Is that song? It was every time Cinderella ran away from him, he was like, that cheeky girl, I must go find her. I was like, what?
By the second time she ran away, I was also busting up laughing, because the narrator's like, and she ran away again. Cinderella is played by Anna Kendrick in this movie. Perfectly cast.
I think there was like one complaint I could say about the movie is that the accents are crazy everywhere. Like, there, at least Emily Blunt obviously has her British one. Anna Kendrick is very modern. Meryl Streep is very proper.
I'm okay with it though, because it fits. Yeah. I don't think it matters too much. Yes, and I also think Emily Blunt and James Corden playing the Bakers too are great. I think they're excellent in this movie. Pretty much everyone all around is flawless, I would say.
I love how they don't ever say it out loud, but it's just kind of amusing how they mention how Cinderella can just talk to birds. And like, I think maybe it's Little Red at the end where she's like, you can just talk to them.
Yeah.
And like, she looks really confused and she's like, wait.
Yeah, no, it's pretty great. I enjoyed the hell out of this movie. My only real complaint is I like the dark turn that the movie takes in the third act, but I feel like the shift to it is not very gradual. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that could be because as a musical, it obviously has like an intermission usually. And that could have been that point where like you have the intermission, like, oh, and a couple years later. And that I could probably pinpoint it as that was the point in the shift.
That makes sense. And having, you know, unfamiliar with the musical, maybe I was just like, oh, well, this just like, you know, I liked the turn. I liked the outcome of it. But like, it felt like you were just like, you took a hard right turn onto a dirt road. Just like it was kind of bumpy.
A little bit. And I agree with you there. It felt a little bit weird all of a sudden where it was like, oh, everyone's happy, but no.
Yeah, which I did like. I mean, they foreshadow that pretty obviously that that it's not going to be the happy ending that that you expect it to be. But yeah, it was. I think out of all the movies coming out on Christmas Day, this is. I haven't seen The Gambler yet or Big Eyes, but this is the most purely enjoyable one, I think, of the ones that I've seen.
I agree with you. Out of all the movies, and I've seen all the Christmas releases, I would definitely say Into the Woods is my favorite. Big Eyes is also a pretty good one. The Gambler I liked. But Into the Woods also has a more family approach. So, like, if you are seeing a movie with a family on Christmas, even though there are some, like, themes in this movie that are a little bit more adult, it's still a PG movie.
Mm-hmm. I was a little surprised that it's PG. Not that there's anything overtly, I would say, contextual about it, but just the tone of the movie, I'm surprised that it got a PG.
It's almost like an 80s PG. Like, you know, like...
It is. It's like, which is funny, because we're doing a Burton retrospective for the site, and I just watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure for the first time, and that movie is batshit crazy, and it's a kid's movie, and it's PG, and it's like, and it came out in 85, and it reminds me of something like that, or like Labyrinth, or
even Beetlejuice is one. Even E.T. has a lot of, like, as an adult, I see, like, there's a lot more cursing, and I've noticed it a lot more.
Yes. Or fucking Gremlins is PG. Yeah.
So Into the Woods is that kind of PG, where it's like, oh, you can take your kids, and they probably won't understand anything that's going on, and they'll probably like it.
It's one of those movies, like, one of my favorite movies of all time from our childhood, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which I think it's another one of those, like, two. It's one of those movies that you'll watch as a kid and you'll enjoy it, and then you'll watch the kids who will grow up and watch it as an adult and realize all the, like, fucked up things about it.
Yeah. It's very dark. I actually even had to just check to make sure it was PG, because for a while I was on the fence wondering what it was. Mm-hmm.
The other thing, I wouldn't say this is a knock against the movie, but this is a knock maybe against, like, a studio model. I kind of noticed the special effects in this movie aren't anything to write home about, but then again, the movie's not, you know, it doesn't matter about the special effects. That's not the selling point of this movie. But I didn't think they were any worse than anything in Maleficent or Oz the Great and Powerful, which are like $250 million productions. So maybe scale back a little bit. That's my food for thought.
What I thought was really interesting about that, though, is there are giants in the movie, and they kind of almost conceal them, which I thought was a little bit brilliant, because I think that giants are the hardest thing to do CGI of, because it's just really weird to see a huge giant person.
Mm-hmm. As evident by Jack the Giant Slayer.
Yeah. Or Harry Potter 5.
Yeah, that too. Or even the first one. Even you had the troll, and he's a giant. He's big. He's not a giant, but he's big, and it looks kind of not very good. Like, it looks very dated if you go back and watch it.
Yeah, so I kind of like how they tried to conceal the giant a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I did too. They shrouded it in fog and mystery, and just showed like feet and things like that and head. So yeah, I was impressed by that too. I agree.
Yeah, and if you said that this was made for a lot less of a budget than, say, Maleficent, then that was really impressive that they could make CGI look just like those movies that have those giant blockbuster budgets.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, the budget was this. I've heard 40 and I've heard 50 million. But either way, for this ensemble and that type of like special effect work, like that's a pretty modest budget.
And the costuming is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Anna Kendrick's Cinderella dress, the golden one, it looks so beautiful. It almost looks like watery, like melted gold, like on her. And it's gorgeous.
It makes me wish that she was the Cinderella in the Cinderella movie that's coming out.
It makes me wish that they had that dress in the Cinderella movie that was coming out.
That too. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And like the costuming's great. The cast is great. I mean, sometimes you can tell The Woods looks a little bit set-like, but then again, it's a musical production and I feel like it works in that way. And mm-hmm. it's still like lavish and really beautiful.
It is. I agree. And, you know, it's been so long since I've seen it at this point because the screening was just so early for it. I actually really want to go see it again when it hits theaters in a couple days.
I have a screener copy of it was sent to me and I'm going to totally watch it again before I break it.
Oh, yeah, totally. I would do the same thing. And go see it in the theater because it sounds like you haven't seen it on the big screen.
No, I plan on doing that when I get back from Europe, but I leave on Christmas, so I think it'll still be out 2 weeks later. This movie definitely going to probably soar into February.
I think this movie's going to have some legs, and I hope it does. I hope it does. Like I said, you know, out of all the Christmas movies that I've seen, and you've seen because you've seen them all, and the only other big one, which Jonathan and I are going to discuss after we talk about this, is Unbroken. So, yeah, I think Into the Woods is your best bet for families and adults, too.
Yeah, it's surprisingly the best family movie you could ever see on Christmas. And Unbroken, I understand, is very, like, oh, Hallmarky. But, I don't know, Into the Woods has a really special something.
It does. It really, really does. So, yeah, surprised the hell out of me in pretty much every regard. Exceeded your expectations that were already pretty, pretty high for it. So yeah, I don't think we could recommend this movie enough.
Yeah, no, I can't recommend this movie enough. It's great.
I'm gonna kill him.
Then they shoot you.
I don't give a damn. Let him shoot me.
That's not how we beat him. We beat him by making it to the end of the war alive. That's how we do it. That's our revenge.
If I can take it, I can make it.
Precisely.
My brother Pete used to say that. He used to think that I could do anything. He used to think that I was better than I am.
Who says you're not?
All right, so now I'm joined by Jonathan Romo. How's your Sunday afternoon going, man?
Really lazy. I'm still wearing sweatpants, so there we go.
I am too. I stayed up hanging out with friends till the sun came out. So so yeah, definitely a lazy day for me as well. But so we're here to talk about probably one of the big movies to come out on Christmas Day, which is Angelina Jolie's Unbroken. So I guess on initial viewing, what did you think about Unbroken?
It is what it appears to be, but to a lesser extent. We both know it's an Oscar bait film. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really do a good job of hiding that, but it felt empty, I guess is how I should say. For a film that's supposed to inspire, it felt empty.
It felt very by the numbers. Yeah. I'm with you there. It felt really... The issue, we kind of talked about this even before, or no, you had seen the movie already. I hadn't, but even before I had seen it, we talked about how this person's true story, Louis Zamperini,
yeah.
I bet is extraordinary. I bet the book is excellent. I bet, you know, what he had gone through and his memoir is great. But the story structure for these movies are so locked into place. And, you know, Angelina Jolie, this is only her second film. I feel like just, you know, isn't experienced enough as a filmmaker to flesh this movie out. And thus, I think, creating the emptiness that you describe.
Yeah, me and Taylor were talking about it. And he mentioned this was like a passion project for her. Mm-hmm. And for a passion project, it kind of lacks passion. I felt like it. I can't really describe what it's missing, but it's missing something that elevates it to what it wants to be.
I feel like the movie misses a little bit of like character perspective. I think that's the one thing, because like we see what Louis goes through in his life, from becoming an Olympic athlete to joining the war to being held in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. It just feels like a checklist of things he went through, but mm-hmm. it doesn't really show you what he's feeling. You just see a guy get beaten and broken down and tortured for like a good half of the movie, but you're like, you don't feel it because he's not fleshed out, and you know he should be. And especially, I'm sure, in the book, because it's his story, it's very fleshed out.
That was one of the biggest problems I actually had with the bird, you know, the Japanese prison camp leader, mm-hmm. because...
Played by Miyavi.
Yeah, played by Miyavi. Because I felt like they had set up some stuff, and, you know, some underlying dad stuff, I guess, or some... He didn't quite live up to expectation. And I felt mm-hmm. like, especially for that latter like hour of the film where he spends his time in the prison camp, I felt that performance was lacking, because, and it's not his fault. It's just that character wasn't developed. That whole camp scene boils down to some screaming and stick hits for me.
Yes. That's really all the best way anybody could have described that scene. That's the biggest issue, because the movie's really quick to demonize that character and not give him dimensions, and then they try to at the end, like you're saying. It's like last hour of the movie is watching a less visceral, less bloody version of Passion of the Christ, really. Like, you're just watching a person get beaten and tortured for a better part of an hour, and you're wondering, like, why. And then they try to give a little explanation as to why, because, you know, Louis being an exceptional person, like living up to expectations, and the other person not doing that. But it comes too little and too late in the movie. I wouldn't say that's a spoiler, really, because it's in a book and it's a true story. So,
yeah, that actually, we're focusing on the last hour. I thought the first hour and a half, or hour 15, however long it is, I thought that was fine. I thought it was pretty good. Like, it was the most enjoyable part. And when they get off the boat, I realized there's still an hour left, and I was kind of done with the movie.
The same way you were with Inherent Vice.
Yeah. It's just like, well, because in the trailers, it's mostly a lot of the camp stuff that you see and his beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of... I don't know. I didn't really think about the raft stuff. I didn't know that was going to be in the movie. Mm-hmm. But I felt like, because Domhnall
Gleeson,
Bill Weasley in the Harry Potter movies, I felt like their dynamic was really good.
I agree.
When he was in the film, you know, the raft scene and a little bit after that, that was my favorite part.
I thought the raft scene was definitely the best part. The movie had anything going for it, it was that sequence, I would say. Because that was like, I feel like, weirdly enough, that felt more visceral than the things that the camp did, because you felt like you were with them. You felt like you were like exhausted and like burning in the heat with them and fighting off sharks, which one scene scared the crap out of me, even though I knew it was coming, but yet it still got me. But like from the very beginning, there was something like just off-puttingly unremarkable about this movie. Like even for the very beginning, they're in a plane, and it's like, you've seen every, you know, World War II set movie start in a plane, and there's a battle, and then it cuts to a flashback of his life, which it only does twice. I thought that structure was going to carry throughout the rest of the movie, and it doesn't. So you don't really get like his background seems like skipped through just to get to mm-hmm. the camp stuff.
So it only flashback twice.
That I remember.
Were they longer flashbacks?
They were longer. Like
they got quite a bit of information in there.
That's true. They were longer. And it's not that they didn't get enough information. I just felt like it was so quick, I felt, for me. Yeah. Like, I felt like they were just like, we got to get through this. We got to get through this. But they didn't really flesh it out a whole lot. Like, him as a kid he was bullied a lot. But it's like he's sneaking liquor when he's a kid, too. Which I thought that stuff was kind of interesting. But
yeah. That's probably why I did enjoy the first hour and 15, because I was interested at least in his backstory, And then when it got a little more routine, mm-hmm. like in the war stuff, at least the dynamic between him and Gleason was a lot better than the dynamic created between him and Ishihara.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I was still compiling my thoughts. Go for it if you got one.
I was going to say the only problem I really had with that with the pre-war stuff was it felt forced in certain parts, in dialogue specifically. It's featured in the trailer, and I write about it in my review. Certain quotes, it's just like, if you can take it and you can make it, and then a moment of pain is worth a lifetime of glory. I look at Taylor when those scenes are said, and I'm just like, well, I guess we'll see that later in the movie. Like, it sums up what the movie's supposed to be about, but their placement in the film feels forced. It's just kind of saying to the audience, get what this is supposed to be about.
Yeah, they're ready-made movie quotes. That's basically what they are, essentially. Like, did you ever see, have you ever seen Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood?
Is that the full title?
That is the full title. It's like a spoof of like, it's like the Wayans Brothers spoof on like Boys in the Hood and like Menace to Society, like those urban crime movies that came out in the early 90s. In the spoof movie, whenever Sean Wayans or anybody in the movie for the matter, like talks about like, you know, like poverty and like their, like anything that's heavy handed in the movie, because some of those movies have that, the mailman instantly comes out of nowhere and goes, message, like, making fun of the fact that those movies do, and that's basically what this does. It's like, it's a message. Yeah. This is what you're gonna see the rest of the movie. Yeah,
it just felt like it was shoving it down my face, and I was like, I get what you're trying to do. I understand what this story is supposed to do and what feelings it's supposed to elicit, but it never elicits them for me.
No, it doesn't. I just sat there for most of the movie, kind of just stonewalled, essentially. Like, some of it looks gorgeous. It's shot by Roger Deakins, which is one of my favorite cinematographers, but even then still looked kind of flatter than his normal work. But I was just like, I get the mechanics of the film, and I get like it's well-intentioned and it's like well-made technically, but it's just, there's something really hollow about it, because I feel like it's more interested in the journey and not the characters. And for this movie, that's a problem. Even though the actors, I feel like, do a good job with the material that they're given. Like, I think Jack O'Connell and Domhnall Gleeson are very good in the movie, despite having some, like, you know, it's either some really bad dialogue or just not a lot to do. But I think they make the most of it.
Yeah, that's specifically what I was saying in the review. Like, I can tell that they're doing some really good acting.
Mm-hmm.
Just the film doesn't help them at all. It doesn't give them anything to do.
No,
really,
it doesn't. And I feel like, you know, again, not to be mean, I think she has talent, and I think she can be go somewhere as a filmmaker for sure. I just think
Sony doesn't.
So yes, Sony. Yeah. well, that's a conversation for another day, I would say. But Angelina Jolie, just, this is a big leap as a project. Like, she almost needed a stepping stone in between In the Land of Blood and Honey and this movie to like kind of hone her craft a little bit. And then I think she would have been able to tell the story with the justice that it needed. But I feel there's just something so routine about it, because she's still learning. I feel like to flesh out an entire story, because it just needed more flesh and blood. Needed more development.
This was her second film?
Second movie, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to have to change that. I thought it was her first. I wasn't sure.
Oh, no, she did a movie called In the Land of Blood and Honey a couple years ago.
Okay.
So it was definitely a much smaller movie than this one. But
yeah, this seems like a big undertaking, especially for your second film.
Oh, definitely. No, for sure. So, for sure.
I will say, in that regard, where we were talking about not feeling anything, I think the best scene and maybe my favorite part was actually when the movie's technically over. You know that short, I don't really think this is a spoiler because this is a real life situation, and it actually happened like last summer,
mm-hmm.
during the Olympics. That short little snippet of him just running.
Yes.
Through the crowd, and I like, the movie's over, and I'm just like, that kind of elicited more emotion in its 10 seconds than the 8,000 the entire movie tried to do.
I agree 100%. It's kind of weird. I felt that recently in a couple movies, like the end credits. Like Exodus was dedicated to Tony Scott, and that's the most emotion I felt during that movie. Night at the Museum was dedicated to Mickey Rooney and Robin Williams. That was the most emotion I felt in that movie. In the end credits, I agree. Yeah, the actual Louis Zamperini, I keep screwing up his name. The actual Louis Zamperini, seeing him, that was pretty heartwarming. But everything else just felt like, I guess you appreciate, but like you definitely know there's something missing.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, that perfectly sums it up. Like, they're trying. I know they're trying, and there's something there, but they don't grasp it completely.
Agree. Like, I could never think this is a bad movie because it's so its heart's so it's in the right place that you know you have to appreciate it. But it is not a good movie. I can just say that it is not.
I think it's a movie that people's moms will want to see.
Yep, I don't deny that.
I write this. This is for anyone who ends up reading the review. This is I'm pulling a lot of things that I said from it because you know I wrote the review. But I picture my girlfriend's mother being like, "Oh, this is what we should see." You know, it's because it's supposed to be heartwarming. It's supposed to be emotional. Mm-hmm. But it's an empty shell.
It is. Me. It's a movie that knows its audience really. Like, yeah, it knows its audience, and it knows that audience wants to see that on screen, and so
It's going to come out at the perfect time when you're with your family and your mom's going to drag everyone to go see it.
Oh yeah. Plus that book is incredibly popular, so it's going to do well.
I it does make me a little, it's same with Inherent Vice, a little more interested in the book material. If it were to flesh out the character more and just give me more insight to the man himself instead of the situations he was put in, I guess.
I agree. I definitely agree. It's funny. You mentioned like snippets from the trailer. I had not seen the, I guess, quote unquote, final trailer for the movie. Mm-hmm. But when I watched The Theory of Everything the other night, a trailer for it played before it at 2.5 minute final trailer. And it's the movie. It's the whole movie. Like everything is given away. And I'm like, I wish I would have watched this trailer because then I wouldn't have had to watch the movie because it starts with like, I think the trailer even starts on the plane and then it's flashbacks and then it's on the boat and then it's in the camp. And it was like, I was watching it with the theater manager of the theater I'm working at. And I lean in and I go, that's the movie. That's the entire movie right there in that trailer.
Saved you 2:15 right there.
Yeah, exactly. It saved you 2 hours and 15 minutes. So.
Which it felt longer. I thought it was 2.5.
It did feel longer. That's I agree with that. It's a slog. It's kind of a slog of a movie.
Because the first up to the raft stuff, it felt like it took a lot longer, which was fine. Like I said, it felt like a full movie at that point. Like something I was done because I was like, oh, I get the point. I get it. He got through this. And like we said earlier, that raft stuff, I really like the raft stuff, and especially with the subtle differences and like their skin peeling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It got me more engaged than the next hour that I had to sit through.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, we're saying you know if you're the audience for this movie, basically that we're saying. So if you are, take a chance. If you were leery or you know, unfortunately cynical about it, like we were going in, you may want to try something else.
Yeah,
for Christmas. Any other thoughts on Unbroken?
No, nothing I can think of, man.
All right. Awesome. Well, cool. Thank you for logging on and talking about it. It was,
no problem.
It was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, by the way, read my review.
Yes.
Just to get it. I put a lot of effort in this one.
Yeah, it'll be out this week before Christmas Day. Yeah. So yeah, please read Jonathan's review.
I'll tell you something. These Marines keep rushing in like they're doing. They're going to have their asses shot off.
Oh, the Marines. They don't get the training we do. Half these guys were civilians 6 months ago.
Well, let's coach him up. I'll show them how team guys do it. I'll leave the unit on the street.
No, we can't do that. We need you on Overwatch.
Oh, come on. If I'm on the street, Mark,
look, I can house to house is the deadliest job here, man. You got some sort of savior complex?
I just want to get the bad guys, but if I can't see them, I can't shoot them.
Look, all these guys, they know your name. They feel invincible with you up there.
They're not.
They are if they think they are. Why don't you just keep banging on the long gun? We'll let these dogs sniff out Zakali.
I'm recording.
Good.
All right. Now I'm joined by Lila Stanley. How are you doing today, Lila?
I'm doing great, Ryan. It's the best time of year for the movie, so can't ask for more.
No, it really is the best time, and sounds like you and I have been catching up on a lot of things lately.
Yes, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's great. So you're here to talk about a movie option that isn't really available for the rest of the country till January, but for our New York and LA listeners, American Sniper, the new film from Clint Eastwood, is hitting on Christmas, which you've had a chance to see. What did you think about the new Eastwood movie?
Overall, I did enjoy it. With Clint Eastwood, you know, you never expect a whole lot of special effects and CGI, so the war scenes were very well done, very realistic. You can tell that, you know, it's very practical effects. So I like that as well. I thought Bradley Cooper did a great job also. Most actors get a lot of credit when they drop a significant amount of weight, but he really goes all out. He gained almost 40 pounds of muscle for the role, so it was very, very great to see him just take a really serious role. We've seen him kind of mature into really sophisticated and serious actor over the past few years, so this is just a great role for him. And I also enjoyed his Texas accent as a Texan. That was kind of fun, very, very fun to hear. But I thought it was very well made. I've also read Chris Kyle's book, so I'm pretty familiar with his story, so it was very interesting to see it come to life. I did have a few smaller issues, and they were mostly with the editing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was the opening sequence, which we've seen in the trailers, is really just two views. It's when Chris Kyle is in his sniper position, and a woman and a child are coming out with they have some kind of a bomb, or I forget. It's an RKG, I believe. And that editing sequence that we open up with, I just was nitpicking that. It just drove me insane. I didn't like how they shifted views pretty quickly. But, you know, that was really the only portion of the film that the editing was a problem enough to take me out of it. The rest of it was pretty well done. But just stuff like that is kind of hard for me to ignore.
Did it... because we've all seen that first trailer that came out that you're discussing. Is the story structure, like, does it cut back and forth between that moment and, like, flashbacks? Is that how it is, or does it just immediately cut to flashbacks?
It does do, I'd say about the first 30 minutes of the film are flashbacks, so we kind of get a little bit of Chris's upbringing, about 10 minutes or so of that, and then we go into his early career. He was a bull rider in Texas, so we get to learn a little bit about him, but not a lot of background. So if you're going into this without reading the book, you may be sort of missing out on some really important points in his life, because he doesn't even join the SEALs until he's 30.
Oh, wow.
So that's, you know, 30 years of character development we don't really get to see.
That makes sense. That's tough. That's tough. Even though the film's like, what, 2 hours and 15 minutes somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. It's even hard then to compact all that into one story. Mm-hmm. So, and like we were kind of talking about off the mic about another film that's out recently, like it's hard to make not inspirational necessarily, but like a true story, because the movie template's there and it just plugs in what somebody's extraordinary story is. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like this one at least avoids a lot of those trappings.
Yeah, I think I kind of compared it to Lone Survivor, which we were talking about at this point last year. And the thing I liked more about American Sniper was with Lone Survivor, it also almost gets like one of those 80s action hero feel to it at some point. Like they're Superman in a way. And American Sniper, I mean, I could just tell that they really tried to ground this in that Chris is normal guy. He's grounded with his family, God and country. So I kind of appreciated that aspect more than maybe Lone Survivor or some of our other typical action films.
Mm-hmm. That's true, because Lone Survivor is, I mean, it's a very visceral film, and as we talked about, very well-made visceral film on that sort of level, but... because we don't really get much character development in that film, and they do endure a lot, and I don't doubt that they did in real life, but you're right, it does seem like they overcome some astronomical odds, like a Superman in that way.
Yeah, definitely. But I think, you know, a lot of the credit needs to go to Bradley Cooper here. I very, very much liked his performance. It's nice to kind of see him out of his pretty boy status. He just kind of seemed like an everyman's man, and I thought he did great. I also really enjoyed Sienna Miller. She plays his wife, Taya, and I thought she did a great job. I'm not very familiar with her work, but I did see she was in Foxcatcher.
Yeah, I was about to say she was in that as well. She didn't really have a huge part in that, unfortunately. I mean, she was good, but I mean, the story was more centered around the three, the wrestling story in that regard. So, but she was really solid in that movie. I think the only other thing I've seen her in off the top of my head is the really bad G.I. Joe movie.
Yes.
She was the Baroness in that one.
We don't speak of those, so yeah.
No, which, I mean, to be fair, she was one of the best parts of that movie, if you can say something about it. So, yeah, that's really good. And Bradley Cooper continues to impress, it sounds like, which is great. Mm-hmm. I thought his dramatic turn in The Place Beyond the Pines last year was his, like, peak performance. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd say this is definitely on par with that. I can't wait to see what he does just in the future. He's very, very talented.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. So is this, it's kind of interesting because Clint Eastwood, I think, delivers like usually pretty solid movies, like consistently solid movies, but like he only delivers a masterpiece every, I don't know how long, like that. There's only a couple of his movies I would call masterpieces. Unforgiven's one of them, yeah. Mystic River's another. But a lot of people were saying ahead of time, like, that this one could be one of those, but it doesn't sound like it's quite to that level.
I don't think it's quite there yet. I think because this is a singular character-driven film, really Chris is the only character that you get to know. All of the supporting players are just sort of his soldiers who are with him. His wife is also just a supporting character. I think when you compare it to something like Mystic River or Unforgiven, there are multiple characters who are developed fully, who we really get a chance to explore with. So that's the biggest difference with this. And it's so funny when you talk about Eastwood, because earlier this year we saw him in Jersey Boys, and now 6 months later, he's made a really solid war film. So he's just so versatile. Very, very talented guy, but I think it really misses a mark in being considered a masterpiece of his.
But a solid movie nonetheless.
Yeah, very solid. He has a pretty distinct style. I don't know, things feel a little choppier. Maybe that's a poor way to describe it. But
I mean, you're on the right track there. It's a very, I don't want to say flat because I feel like that's like reductive argument. But his style is not very flashy. It's kind of like he usually lets scenes play out and lets actors act. Because that's the thing. He's an actor's director, and that's why actors want to work with him, because he knows what he wanted as an actor being directed. So he's very good at directing actors. So, you know, he's not a strong visual director, because that's just not where his style lies in.
Definitely so. I was very curious to see how they ended this film, because for those of you who don't know, Chris Kyle died in 2013. He was killed at a shooting range in Texas, and that was really after they had already finished the screenplay for the film, so they had to go in and make some changes. So I kind of wish that we would have gotten a better, well-rounded ending. It's very abrupt. So you don't get much closure with that.
That's unfortunate. And I just kind of familiarized myself with the story, in preparation for this, conversation. I actually did not know that he passed away in 2013. Tragically, it sounds like,
yes.
Which is, really unfortunate. So yeah, it sounds like it ends up, without giving anything away, just ends abruptly and unfortunately in an unsatisfying manner in that regard.
Yeah, I think his life, maybe the film is, you know, that's just a way to kind of echo his life. It's just, it was cut short, and the film kind of echoes that at the end.
Since the film sounds like it might be a little cut short as well.
It just kind of felt that way at the end. But overall, very solid action film. The set pieces were great. I mean, you really felt like you were on the ground with the soldiers. I loved the real action. It just very, very well-made action film. And also does a good job of incorporating character. Because my biggest pet peeve is poor character development. So I thought that given the time frame they had, I kind of wish we could have dived into more of his pre-Seals life. But, you know, overall, very, very good film.
Good, good. That's good to hear. I'm looking forward to seeing it when it comes out. Yeah, two films in 1 year. I mean, he's done that before, but that's, I mean, that's definitely, he's prolific, to say the least.
He is.
Eastwood is.
I really thought that Jersey Boys is maybe one of the flashiest he's done.
I still haven't seen it. Is that worth checking out?
I think so. I actually enjoyed it. I don't know much. I didn't know much about the musical going in, but I love the music. They actually, you know, they cast real Broadway performers and not just kind of actors off the street. Christopher Walken was the only big name that I knew, so I think it's worth seeing. It's something totally unique in his filmography. I doubt we'll get to see him put out another musical.
No, it just seemed really bizarre. I was like, oh, yeah. That's really. I mean, I guess he's a jazz man from what I had heard, so it made sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, the doo-wop isn't like my favorite genre in the history of music, but I'll definitely check it out at some point.
Yeah, and it's worth seeing. But he's very, very, he's usually very solid when it comes to war films. He's made a handful now that are all worth seeing, and he's just a very talented guy, and you never know what he's going to do.
Yeah, that's true. He's pretty unpredictable. Mm-hmm. So. Anything else?
It's good. I don't really see it getting in the future. I don't foresee it getting much Oscar love, though.
It's just a crowded field this year, I think. Maybe in a weaker year, it might have snuck in somehow, since he is kind of a favorite in the Academy, Eastwood is. But, yeah, I just think, you know, stronger films came out throughout other times of the year, like Boyhood and Grand Budapest Hotel, that I just don't think this has the traction that those movies do.
Yeah, and the Best Actor field is quite crowded this year as well. I think Cooper, this is definitely one of his better performances, but it's not strong enough to get him in.
No, I wouldn't think so, especially because I think that Keaton, Carell, Redmayne, and there's one other one I was thinking of that are pretty much locked, so it only leaves a fifth spot, and it's probably not going to go to him.
Mm-hmm. We do have some hope, maybe with some technical awards, similar to Lone Survivor. They took home, I believe it was Best Sound Mixing. So maybe they'll get some recognition, but I think it may just be a little too, not patriotic, but maybe controversial to be a big contender, sort of similar to Zero Dark Thirty.
It makes sense. I mean, I think this movie's going to do well in the box office when it comes out, I think. Really think it's going to do very well.
Yeah. Not to compare it to Lone Survivor so much, but, I mean, they're just very similar, and then they're coming out in really similar release dates as well, and that film did fantastic.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's right to compare, because I don't think it's an accident that Warner Brothers is releasing it at the same time that that Universal released Lone Survivor last year, because it did so well. Mm-hmm. And there really isn't much out in the way of things in January that it would make sense.
True. Yeah. To quote Dr. Evil from Saturday Night Live last week, the best way to kill a movie is put it in January. So that's usually the track record of that.
I still need to watch that. I just heard that was on last night.
It's great. You have to check it out.
I do. I really do. Well, anything else on American Sniper before we wrap this segment up?
Not much. I mean, I think that if you're looking for something, if you're a fan of the action genre, maybe something you want to go see with your family, I think this would be a good one to see.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely going to, you know, go see it when it comes out. So maybe take my family. So.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you for logging on and talking about American Sniper. It has me excited, and hopefully has our listeners excited to see it too.
Absolutely. You can't go wrong with Eastwood ever.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely not. All right, so this concludes our 34th episode of the Gotcha Movies podcast. As always, you can check out our news, reviews, and this podcast at gotchamovies.com. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Gotcha Movies. This podcast is also on iTunes, so be sure to subscribe to us there. Leave a comment or rating, or if you're so inclined, it helps us know what we're doing right and what we can improve on. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can listen to the other podcasts that I co-host, Over Under Movies, with Aka Aga Kozak and Eric McClanahan, where we pick one overrated movie and one underrated movie and discuss them. So thank you to my co-host for joining me on this wonderful Christmas time episode, and thank you, listeners, for sticking with us throughout the past year. This is our 1 year anniversary of the Gotcha Movies podcast, so thank you for all your support, and if you keep listening, we'll keep putting out episodes. So be sure to join us after the new year. We'll be back in the middle of January with our reviews of Selma and Black Hat.